Okay, take your Bibles this evening. Let's open them. The book of Judges. We're going to open tonight to Judges chapter 10. Judges chapter 10. I told my wife when we were eating supper tonight, I said she might want to stay home. So we were going to go through one of the stories tonight that she really does not like in the book of Judges. So,
all right.
Yeah. So, how's that for us opening line here for the study?
You got me. I'm eager to find out. Actually.
You're wondering what this story is in the book of Judges. Last week we walked through a number of judges in the first part of this, and as you remember, they're under judges for over 400 years. So we've got quite a stretch of period of time, which was helpful. I never thought of this when I used to read through the book of Judges or went through it in Sunday school class as a kid, that this was stretched out over time and that all these judges were operating in different places throughout the land of Israel. They weren't all just working from one headquarters over time. And in Judges chapter 10, and we have this cycle, remember, we've repeated it again. We come to it again tonight, verse 6. The sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. They served the Baals, that's the male god, and the Ashtaroth, that's the female, that's his consort, the gods of Aram, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the sons of Ammon. So they're worshiping, and I believe when he says the Baals and the Ashtaroth, and then he goes through these, probably what you're doing is all of these countries have gods that are comparable to Baal and Ashtaroth. Yes.
Judges 10, right?
Judges 10 and verse 6, yes. Yeah. So all of these,
you're reading 3:7.
Oh, no.
That was 6.
No. Judges 10:6.
It must say exactly the same thing.
In Judges 3:7.
Yeah.
I didn't even look, but it wouldn't be surprising because we have this.
The
Baals and the Ashtaroth.
The first part is the practice, then it goes on.
Yeah. It goes on, it says in verse 7, and the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the Philistines. Remember, the Philistines are their enemies to the southwest. They're kind of along the coast down near where Gaza is today. In fact, it was Gaza back then also. And into the hands of the sons of Ammon. The sons of Ammon are over on their east. And they afflicted and crushed the sons of Israel that year for 18 years. So again, we've been giving you a place for you to put these down as you're filling out your chart in here. 18 years. They were afflicted, the sons of Israel, who were beyond the Jordan and Gilead in the land of the Amorites. And that's what the people of Ammon did. And the sons of Ammon crossed the Jordan to fight also against Judah and Benjamin and the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was greatly distressed. And then the sons of Israel cried to the Lord, saying, "We have sinned against you, for indeed we have forsaken our God and served the Baals." And the Lord said to the sons of Israel, "Did I not deliver you from the Egyptians, the Amorites, the sons of Ammon, and the Philistines? Also when the Sidonians and the Amalekites and the Maonites, oppressed you, you cried out to me, and I delivered you from their hands. Yet you have forsaken me and served other gods. Therefore, I will deliver you no more. Go, cry out to the gods which you have chosen. Let them deliver you in the time of your distress." And the sons of Israel said to the Lord, "We have sinned. Do to us whatever seems good to you. Only please deliver us this day." And so they put away the foreign gods from among them and served the Lord, or served Jehovah. And he could bear the misery of Israel no longer. And the sons of Ammon were summoned in the camp, and they camped in Gilead. Gilead, remember, is on the east side of the Jordan where the people of Ammon are over there. The sons of Israel gathered together and camped in Mizpah. And the people, the leaders of Gilead, said to one another, "Who is the man who will begin to fight against the sons of Ammon? He will become head over all the inhabitants of Gilead." And we have verse 1 of chapter 11, Jephthah the Gileadite. Gilead, remember, on the other side of the Jordan. So what we have is we're going to have two parallel sets of stories here that are going to go on in the last part of the book of Judges. We're going to have Jephthah, and we're going to have Samson. And they're probably taking roughly about the same time. Jephthah dealing with the problem of the Ammonites, people of Ammon on the east, and Samson dealing with the Philistines down to the southwest. So this is kind of where these two men are judging with regard. And to kind of put this in perspective to think of what's happening. But he's going to take them one at a time. And we have this verse 1, Jephthah the Gileadite was a valiant warrior, but he was the son of a harlot. And Gilead was the father of Jephthah, and Gilead's wife bore him sons, and when his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out. So we have a rejected son, but he's a mighty warrior. And so as this Jephthah is going to be called up to judge, we're told down in the context here, I've just got to keep my bearings on my notes so we don't get too off track. Verse 9, so Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, if you take me back to fight against the sons of Ammon, and the Lord gives them up to me. And we tried to do this last week, pointing out that as these judges judged, that it was important for us not to get so focused on the judge themselves that we lost sight of the fact that God was doing this. So this is, even Jephthah here says, if the Lord gives them up to me, will I then become your head? And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, the Lord is witness between us. Surely we will do as you have said. Then Jephthah went up with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and chief over them, that is, leading them here in war. And Jephthah spoke all the words before the Lord at Mizpah. And so so we have this scenario where they have they're going to actually take on this other god. Israel has acknowledged their sin in all of this. Their God's raising up a judge for them. And if you look down in the context, verse 29, Judges 11:29, continues to stay in this, continue to deal with Jephthah. It says, and the Spirit of the Lord, Spirit of Jehovah, came upon Jephthah. It's very important. We're not talking about a man just acting out of his own strength. And again, we tried to really emphasize this last week, but again, try to emphasize it tonight. This is a man operating in connection with what God's doing. So the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him so that he passed through Gilead and Manasseh, and then he passed through Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead he went on to the sons of Ammon. And Jephthah, here it is now, made a vow to the Lord. Now let's make it very clear. God had told Israel how to go about making a vow. Under the law, he told them that they could indeed make vows. I was telling Peg this tonight when we were eating supper. I said, one of the things that always runs through my mind over the last couple of years is, why did God ever set a vow system up for these people? Because a vow was essentially a person coming and saying, God, if you do this for me, then I do this for you. And why did God do that? Why did God go into a, shall we say, a vow or a bargaining situation, relationship with these people? I don't know. But nonetheless, it was something that God set up under the law. He did allow these people to do it. And Jephthah made a vow to Jehovah. And what we're just trying to point out here in verse 30 is the Bible doesn't prohibit vows. In fact, even in the New Testament, it doesn't prohibit vows. But I would say more importantly, the New Testament doesn't encourage us in making vows, nor does it actually tell us how to go about making a vow. But James talks about vows. But James was a Jew that was very familiar with the law, and I believe was carrying over what they'd done under the law into a New Testament context. Paul, likewise, on more than one occasion was under a vow. One of them apparently being a Nazarite vow, because he had let his hair grow and he had to cut his hair and go to Jerusalem because he had a vow on his head, which was the same thing we're going to run into with Samson. So there were people that made vows, but I would say all the vows cited in the New Testament were all vows that were made by Jews that understood an Old Testament context. I really do not think that I don't know how you as a New Testament believer would go about making a vow, and I don't know that God encourages us to make vows. Now, we studied that a couple of years ago when we went through, I don't know, what was that, about 2 years ago or so, and we went through biblical communication, and we talked quite a bit about vows in there, because there are a lot of Christians today, a lot of people for that matter, that make vows with God. They find themselves in a desperate situation and they make promises to God, you take care of my desperate situation, you get me out of this and I will, so on and so forth. Jephthah made a vow, and he says, verse 30, if you will indeed give the sons of Ammon into my hand, then it shall be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the sons of Ammon. It shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering. Okay? An offering of fire. Offering that goes up in fire, literally, is the idea. So Jephthah crossed over to the sons of Ammon to fight against them, and the Lord gave them into his hand, and he struck them with a very great slaughter. From Aor to the entrance of Minnith, 20 cities, and as far as Abel-Karamim, so the sons of Ammon were subdued before the sons of Israel. Remember, Jephthah is leading them in war, but God's giving him success as he's leading these people in war. Verse 34, when Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah, behold, his daughter was coming out to meet him with tambourines and with dancing. Now she was his one and only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. And it came about when he saw her that he tore his clothes and said, alas, my daughter, you have brought me low, and you are among those who trouble me, for I have given my word to the Lord. I cannot take it back. And so she said to him, my father, you have given your word to the Lord. Do to me as you have said, since the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the sons of Ammon. And she said to her father, let this thing be done to me. Let me alone 2 months, that I may go to the mountains and weep because of my virginity, I and my companions. And then he said, go. And he sent her away for 2 months, and she left with her companions and went on the mountains because of her virginity. And it came about at the end of 2 months that she returned to her father, who did to her according to the vow which he had made. And she had no relations with the man or did not know a man. Thus it became a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went yearly to commemorate the daughter of Jephthah, the Gileadite, 4 days in the year. Now, take your Bibles and turn to Deuteronomy chapter 12. Deuteronomy chapter 12, look with me at verse 31. It says, you shall do it in this way toward the Lord your God, or not do it in this way toward the Lord your God. For every abominable act which the Lord hates, they have done for their gods, for they even burn their sons and daughters in the fire of their gods. Turn to chapter 18 in Deuteronomy also. Deuteronomy 18, verse 10. There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or his daughter pass through the fire, or one who uses divination, one who practices witchcraft, or one who interprets omens, or a sorcerer. So, the law did, there's two examples, but the law forbid human sacrifice. Remember, when Abraham took Isaac up on Mount Moriah, and God asked him to offer him, God stopped or forbid Abraham from doing it. And what did God do in forbidding the killing of Isaac? How did God distinguish himself? That's what he did, but how did God distinguish himself? That's what I'm asking. We've talked about this several times, but this is really important for you to get. Because, see, we read that story, and we actually miss the biggest point out of that story.
He
was not like the other gods. See, all these other gods required them to kill their firstborn. And God says, I want you to give your son. And then he says, I don't want you to do that. And then when he establishes Israel as a nation and gives them a law, he says, you aren't going to sacrifice your children. You are going to buy back your son. You're going to offer an offering for him. So God refused human sacrifice. Never asked it. Okay. Keep that in mind as we look at this.
Deuteronomy 18 what?
18:10. It says, there shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or his daughter pass through the fire. Okay. Which had to do with this. It's not walking on hot coals. This had to do with burning your children.
Okay.
Verse 12, too. Oh, in verse 12. For whoever does these things is detestable to the Lord, and because of these detestable things, the Lord your God will drive them out before you. In other words, because the people did these things, that's why I'm pushing them out of the land. Always keep that in mind, because I remember I have an aunt that I remember years ago, and I didn't understand the answer to this, but years ago asked me this question. I don't like the Old Testament. Because why would God tell these people to go in and just kill all these people, wipe them out? That just doesn't seem like the God of the Bible. And I didn't have the answer at the time, other than to say, well, that's what he did. But I actually understand the answer now, having gone through the minor prophets and understand the Old Testament better, that God did that because these people were doing all kinds of horrible, abominable practices in the worship to their God. One of those horrible things being that they practiced human sacrifice, specifically the sacrifice of their children.
So, by forcing the judge to do this, is this saying this is what they were doing the whole time, basically?
By forcing the judge...
Well, telling him to do that after he...
Well, we'll get there in just a second, okay. Ben. Just hold on. Let's turn to Leviticus chapter 27. Leviticus 27. Leviticus chapter 27, verses 1 through 8. And again the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when a man makes a difficult vow, it shall be according to the valuation of persons belonging to the Lord. If your valuation is the male from 20 years even to 60 years old, then your valuation shall be 50 shekels of silver after the shekel of the sanctuary. Or if it is a female, then your valuation shall be 30 shekels. And if it be from 5 years even to 20 years old, then your valuation of the male shall be 20 shekels, for the female 10 shekels. But if they are from a month even to 5 years, then your valuation shall be 5 shekels of silver for the male. For the female, your valuation shall be 3 shekels of silver. And if it be from 60 years old and upward, if it is a male, then your valuation shall be 15 shekels, and for the female, 10 shekels. And if he is poor, then your valuation, then he shall be placed before the priest, and the priest shall value him according to the means of the one who vowed. The priest shall value him. Now, the purpose of this was, is if they actually had been in the process of making a vow, and for whatever reason at the end, when it came to the sacrifices or fulfilling the vow, they weren't able to fulfill the vow, their God provided them a means of actually redeeming that particular individual. Because not that these individuals had not pledged themselves to kill themselves or any human sacrifice, because God forbid that. But if they got themselves in a situation with a vow in which they could not pay, or they just didn't have the resources, then this is what they could pay. And apparently what you're reading here with these shekels is, he's talking about modest amounts of money that's passing for these people that can't do this. He's not talking about, you know, you've got a poor person, we're going to charge them $2,000 to redeem. We're talking about the poor person. If it's a guy, $20. If it's a woman, $15. You know, so it's like that. Just to kind of put it in perspective for you, what he's getting at here. Okay. Now, Exodus chapter 38. Exodus chapter 38. It's talking about the tabernacle that they had set up and how the tabernacle was to be done. And it says in verse 8, moreover, he made, it's talking about what Moses was doing, kind of applying it to what all the people that were working underneath him. He made the laver of bronze with its base of bronze from the mirrors of the serving women who served at the doorway of the tent of meeting. So there were women that were serving at the doorway of the tent. So they served up around the tabernacle. They didn't go inside the tabernacle, but they served in the confines of the tabernacle in front of the door. So there was some service that was being done by the women. This isn't the only passage that gets it. You can go on others, but I'm just providing you a passage to demonstrate this. Now, all of that is to say, if you go back over to the book of Judges, you go back to chapter 11 here. All of that is to say, one of the options in understanding what happened with Jephthah's vow is his daughter comes out, he tears his clothes, he's greatly grieved because this is his daughter, I'm going to have to kill you. But he doesn't have to kill her because, number one, human sacrifice is not acceptable to God. Okay. Number two, there was a means of actually redeeming something in a vow. He didn't have the means of fulfilling it, meaning then that Jephthah could have then provided what was necessary to provide for the redemption of his child, this daughter. And third, this daughter then when it talks about her serving in this, mourning her virginity, would have meant that, that she was going to maintain herself as a perpetual virgin serving at the temple. It's not the only example of that we have. We have Anna in the New Testament. Now, she's not a perpetual virgin, but she's married for 7 years. Her husband dies, and for the rest of her life, she remains single and serves at the temple. Okay? And that's over in the book of Luke. But I'm just saying that is one solution. That he didn't kill her. The reading of the text, however, to be really honest with this, I think the more natural way to take it is that Jephthah did offer his daughter as a sacrifice. That doesn't mean that God asked for it. But at the same time, it never says in the context that Jephthah was particularly punished for doing what he did. Now, the fact that he wasn't punished for doing it is the one that makes me inclined to say, well, he went through this other procedure and redeemed his daughter, and she remained a perpetual virgin serving at the temple, tabernacle at this time. But the other thing is, you read the context, and in the state of affairs in Israel at that time with the horrible things that they were doing, I could see that there's the possibility that he actually did this. That he did offer his daughter. Well, and every
coming out of his house, an animal.
Yeah, I think that's what he was expecting. Figured whatever animal he would see when he came. Well, because you didn't keep your livestock penned. You came to your place and your place was penned in, and your livestock ran around the. You've been to Mexico. You've driven through the backcountry in Mexico. You drive it in everybody's house. Their livestock and runs around inside a fenced in area, and they go in and out of the house. So. Oh, see, when we were down there, you'd see animals, but you'd always see the animals just running around in basically what was a fenced yard around their houses. They're all just packed together like that. But that was the way it was in this context in which they were living. Okay, but here's the point. I don't know if there's a solution. I'm going to tell you, I'm inclined to think that he offered his daughter. That's what I'm inclined to think. It's horrible. I don't like that. I would like it to be the other way. I gave you an option that makes sense in keeping with the scripture, but I don't know that that's actually what happened. I can't make any excuse for Jephthah either. That's the other thing. I can't justify in any way what he did. But it goes back to the word that Leslie used. It's rash. It was a vow that was made that wasn't particularly thought out well.
Yeah, because verse 29, the Spirit of the Lord was upon him. I mean, why would you have to make a vow to somebody who's upon you?
I know. So he should have been able to trust God to deliver these people over rather than having to make this vow. But again, if there's something to take away from that, I think for us as New Testament believers, it's the fact that, number one, God doesn't really ask us to be making vows. And number two, when we are inclined to make vows as New Testament believers, we're probably going to be inclined to make vows that are probably pretty rash. They're probably not particularly well thought out. I mean, think of the people that have been in foxholes fighting war, and there's bullets whizzing overhead and bombs bursting around them out in the landscape, and they're down the hole. Now, mind you, unsaved, I'm just taking an unsaved man, but a believer can do the same thing. God, if you get me out of here and get me home to see my wife or my girlfriend, whatever the situation was, you know, I'm going to marry that girl and we're going to have kids and I'm dedicating my whole life to you and I'm going to give you half of everything that I make the rest of my life. And a lot of those people probably came home. They probably survived and they probably thought a little bit about their vow, maybe even for a while tried to pursue fulfilling that vow, but in the end found it very hard going, well, I don't really want to live my whole life just for God because, I mean, I've got other things I want to do. I always wanted to go into the plumbing business. And now I'm going to have to, you know, go to seminary or something so I can serve God my whole life. and half of all I make? That seems a little extreme. God, how about, let's go to the tithe. Let's go with 10%. Oh, that even maybe is a bit much. Let's cut it back to 5. You just see what I'm saying? It's hard, I think, for people to keep vows. And I think people make vows, and they tend to make vows rather rashly. But number one, God, I don't think, asks for vows.
You know, I've been thinking about this whole thing, you know, what Peggy said about the Spirit of the Lord was upon them. And they still had their volition, even though the Spirit of the Lord was upon them.
Mm-hmm.
And it really isn't too much difference. We have the Spirit indwelling us.
Mm-hmm.
And we still make decisions to do stuff that's way off the wall and sin.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, just it's sort of the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tim, can you break down the Hebrew verse 31? I had understood that the hand in there was an oar. I don't know Hebrew.
I did not bring my Hebrew Bible with me tonight. And do you have your Hebrew Bible on there? See, I didn't bring my Hebrew Bible with me. Can you ask me afterwards, and I can pull it up on my computer, and I can look at the Hebrew text on there. I didn't notice an or in there when I was reading through this and studying, but there may be.
It's interesting when you do, you know, it's not an or in there, then it's a mute point, but verse 31, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph to the Amorites will be the Lord's, or I will sacrifice as a burnt offering. That's how I'd actually had a note in my Bible a long while back. But
well, I'm pulling it up here. I can check this real quick. It won't take me but a second to pull this up.
Because if it's that way, then as you read through it, it gives you an option. That the or would mean if it's an animal I'm going to sacrifice. If not, then I'm going to give it to the Lord. Then it's interesting if you filter it that way. You know, she's now the Lord, so he kind of realizes that she's not going to marry, and he feels bad about it because it's his only daughter, and doesn't have a son, and he's not going to have grandkids, and that would be wretched.
The Jewish society, family is pretty big.
Yeah, so I mean, and you read through it, she goes off with her buddies to the hills, and she's not going to marry, and she's sad, but she comes back. But she, you know, she says, do to me what you said you were going to do. I could see a kid saying that. I could see him going, yeah, go ahead and kill me. But
except, you did have the example with Isaac. It never tells us that Isaac ever fought his father.
Yeah, I mean,
if he did, we just don't have a record of it.
Could have been pretty gung-ho.
Yeah, verse 40. One of the daughters of Israel lamenting about her death or the fact that she never had a family.
Yeah, it just totally changes it.
Yeah, there's no kind of an or in the Hebrew. It just says it shall be, and it shall be for Jehovah, and a burnt offering for him, or literally a burning of a offering going up. So, yeah, there is not a.
So it combines the.
It shall be for the Lord, and it shall be a burnt offering. That's what he says. So. I've actually never even, in kind of going through this, because I've read several commentaries on this, trying to piece, you know, together how other people came at this. And that's why I arrived at some of this other option.
Yeah.
Because it's from commentaries proposing, well, this may be what happened.
Yeah, I mean, kind of has a footnote, and it breaks down the two different scenarios.
Yeah.
Kind of why people, yeah, kind of like what you did, but it's not really quite as elaborate.
It's interesting that God doesn't give us any more information than he does to be able to come to a definitive conclusion on it.
I think that's why it's kind of, if you just read it for what it said, I think you'd say, this is what he did. And we all stand there and scratch our head and say, I do not get how this works.
I don't like that story with Peggy.
That's not the story.
That's not the worst one.
What?
You know, that's
nope.
not the story.
Nope.
Yeah. We may not make it tonight. We sat on this one maybe a little longer than I thought.
You may clean this box.
Yeah.
So you might have to wait till next week.
Peggy says, go ahead and burn her.
Yeah.
Well, if you look into chapter 12 just very quickly, it continues to talk about Jephthah and the men of Gilead and chasing. And one of the problems is the people of Ephraim came out and said, how come you didn't let us go to war? So the people of Ephraim say, kind of like a minor civil war going on. And they go to the fords of the Jordan, that is the place where the water, where the rock was high enough that people could walk across the Jordan, get across it with, you know, just getting your feet wet. And it says in what they did was when people came there, verse 6, then they would say to them, say Shibboleth, Shibboleth, which is a Hebrew word meaning custom. But he said Sibboleth. So it's the difference between sh and s. Same letter in the Hebrew. It's just that there's a little dot that moves back and forth. But in the time they wrote it, there was no dot. It was exactly the same letter, but they pronounced it differently. And the people of Ephraim, they couldn't say Shibboleth. They could only say Sibboleth. It's kind of like during World War II, what was the thing? They'd always say that's the Germans. Say wet whiskey. What's the thing? Wet whiskey. They couldn't say wet whiskey. So they knew they were Germans. That's one of the way that they tell if Germans were supposed to be spies. You know? Because they had problems saying that. Like that. And it said, and as a result of that, doing that, they killed 42,000 of Ephraim.
Oh, wow.
They caught 42,000 people of Ephraim that were trying to escape in that warfare. Okay. We've got some other guys in here. In chapter 12, verses 8 through 10, we have Ibzan that judges Israel 7 years. We have Elon, the next verses, that judged Israel 10 years. Abdon that judged Israel 8 years. And then you come down to chapter 13 and verse 1. It says, and the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines 40 years. And there was a certain man of Zorah of the family of the Danites, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had borne no children. And then the angel of Jehovah appeared to the woman and said to her, behold, now you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and give birth to a son. Now, therefore, be careful not to drink wine or strong drink, nor eat anything unclean. No, it's just an instruction to the mom. You don't do this. For behold, you shall conceive and give birth to a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hand of the Philistines. Remember, a Nazarite, the word Nazar meant separated. Okay? So a Nazarite was a person that was separated. So they're separated from a whole bunch of things. From things they couldn't touch anything that was dead. They couldn't touch anything defiled. They couldn't touch anything, or they couldn't touch any kind of alcohol in any form whatsoever. These were the things that they had to do.
So this came in from church on Sunday.
What?
Sunday school. If he was a Nazarite and he killed the lion, and the lion was dead, and he went back and got honey, and then he killed all those people, how did he be separated from dead?
He wasn't, and that's exactly what happened, because he killed the lion and took the honey. I actually have that note written on here, that technically he would have been unclean. Technically he would have been unclean. So, and I think that's one of the interesting points when you go through this. So.
Did you hear that, Kenya? Because that was our question.
Yeah, he would have been unclean for touching the honey that came out of the carcass of the lion. Anyway, if you read down through the rest of this chapter, they have this conversation with this man. This is, by the way, a good place. If you go to verse 9, it says, and God listened to the voice of Manoah. Let's go. We have to back up. There is something we need to look at in here. One of the things that these people are concerned about here in this passage, and I'm trying to, verse 8. Manoah entreated the Lord and said, O Lord, please let the man of God, whom you have sent, come to us again, that he may teach us what to do for the boy who is to be born. And God listened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of God came again to the woman as she was sitting in the field, but Manoah, her husband, was not with her. She ran and got her husband, said, the man's back there. Verse 11 says, and Manoah rose and followed his wife, and when he came to the man, he said to them, are you the man who spoke to the woman, that is, to his wife? And they end up finding out that, verse 13, this is the angel of the Lord. And verse 15, and Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, please let us detain you so that we may prepare a kid for you. And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, though you detain me, I will not eat your food. But if you prepare a burnt offering, then offer it to Jehovah. For Manoah did not know that he was the angel of the Lord. And Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, what is your name? So that when your words come to pass, we may honor you. But the angel of the Lord said to him, why do you ask my name, seeing it's wonderful? So Manoah took the kid with the grain offering, offered it on the rock to the Lord, and he performed, that is, Jehovah performed wonders while Manoah and his wife looked on. And it came about that when flame went up from the altar, this is like Gideon, remember, when his first sign he asks for, before he asks for the fleece sign, he asks for the sign, I'm going to put a sacrifice out here. And Jehovah, the angel of Jehovah comes up and touches it, and flame shoots out of the altar and consumes it all just by his touch. Well, he does the same thing here. And a flame went up toward heaven, and the angel Lord also ascended in the flame from the altar. And Manoah and his wife saw it. They fell on their faces to the ground. Now the angel Lord appeared no more to Manoah or his wife. And then Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Lord. So Manoah said to his wife, "We shall surely die, for we have seen God." So this is an important passage for demonstrating they recognize that the angel of the Lord is God, number one. Number two, it demonstrates that when the angel of the Lord appeared in this way, he appeared as a man. He didn't appear as a spook. He appears to them as a man. They don't know that he's anything other than a man. They just think he's a man sent from God. They end up finding out that he is God, which also probably tells you something else about the idea of angel. Angels don't have wings. They look like men when they show up. That's not saying that's what they look like to each other, but when they appear to us, they always appear looking like men. So they've got something in their being that when they make themselves visible, they appear to us. The other thing that was important that we went back to verse 8 is Manoah and his wife, for whatever else you can say about this situation with Samson, they want to know how to raise this boy right. They say, "Come, we want him to come back and tell us because we want to do the right thing." Okay. Now, we could take that as parents and say, well, as parents, we ought to pray that God will teach us how to raise our kids right. And that's good, but I don't know that this is the verse to go to for it, because what they're concerned about is he's told them that this child is to be a Nazarite. And they want to know, we want to do all the right things in raising him as a Nazarite. Because remember, if you go back to the book of Leviticus, there are a number of stipulations on what a Nazarite could do. And some of them were indicated briefly by the man, but they want to know it all. Because they really want to make sure, if you're going to give us a son, we want him to be raised properly as a Nazarite in this context. Okay. So, they have a son, verse 24, she gives birth, they name him Samson, which means sunlight. The child grew up and the Lord blessed him. And the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him in Mahanath Dan between Zorah and Eshtol. So it's important that it says, and the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him. And that word to stir is used 5 times in the Old Testament. And every time it's used, it always is used of causing a person to be upset or disturbed. It's not that he's going, hey, I should go do something. I should go avenge God. It's always like, I don't know, but it reminds me of when we played football. I never got this because it's not my character. But you get all these guys, and we'd all get in this big huddle on the end of the thing, and all the guys would start going around and smacking each other on the helmets. Bam, 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 hitting, bam, getting, and they're trying, it's like they're trying to work themselves into a frenzy that we're going to get, we're going to eat these guys alive. And I was always like, okay, I kind of would get into it, but I was going, this is kind of stupid. But, you know, I'm going to go out and hit that guy just as hard, whether I'm all wound up or not, you know. But they do that. But I kind of look at that this is what's happening, that the Spirit's getting him worked up so that Samson's kind of becoming aggressive, because it's always used that way. And frequently it's used of them being stirred up in their spirit, being disturbed, upset, and kind of wound up in their spirit. It's used of Pharaoh. It's used of Nebuchadnezzar. There's used of another king also in the book of Daniel. I can't remember the other one. So, but anyway, it's always used that way in the Bible. We have this situation where, verse 1, I mean, talk about a brat, adult child. Samson went down to Timnah, saw a woman of Timnah, one of the daughters of Philistines. So he came back, told his father and mother, "I saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore, get her for me for a wife." And his father and mother say, you know, these are uncircumcised Philistines. There's nobody here among the family? And he says at the end of it, verse 3, Samson said to his father, "Get her for me, for she looks good to me." The word good in the Hebrew is the word yasher. She looks straight. It's one of the words that's used for righteous. She looks upright to me. Everything's the way it should be. That's the way he looks at it. However, now, and this is important, verse 4. However, his father and mother did not know. This is a tough verse again, another one of the tough verses for us to handle in this context. His mother and father did not know that it was the Lord, for he was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. Because now at that time, the Philistines were ruling over Israel. So why does God work this? The Spirit gets Samson worked up. Samson sees this woman of the Philistines and he wants her, and it's explained to us here that this happens because God is doing this. He's caught bringing this about. And again, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense for us because one of the things God had told them not to do is don't take their daughters in marriage and don't give your daughters to them in marriage. But this is exactly what is happening. Verse 6, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. Oh, he's going down. A young lion comes on him. In verse 5, this is the question that they were asking from the Sunday school class. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, and he tore him as one tears a kid, that is a young goat, though he had nothing in his hands, but he did not tell his father or mother what he had done. Comes back, he finds in verse 8 a swarm of bees, and he eats these things, and he's going to actually use these, and he comes back, I'd end up telling all these stories, and I really don't want to do that. I'm trying to stay on track. So in chapter 14, this woman of the Philistines, when he goes back down to take her, it says, if you go down to, let's see, just trying to make sure, verse 19, oh, that's right, he's trying to get this, he's supposed to marry this gal, okay, that's what's supposed to happen, he's supposed to be married to her, but he makes a deal, and he tells them the riddle about, you know, what was strong, and then what's sweet, and he's talking about the lion, and the honey coming out. And they can't get the riddle, so they're going to, but they get it out of him through his wife. She gets him, coaxes this out of him. This isn't the, Jim and I think we're talking about this on Sunday. He falls for this with this woman. He's going to fall with it the next woman. But it says the result of it is, verse 19, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him then mightily, and he went down to Ashkelon, that's where the Philistines are at, and killed 30 of them, and took their spoil, and gave the changes of clothes to those who told the riddle. And his anger burned, and he went up to his father's house. But Samson's wife was then given to another companion. What ends up happening then, in this context, when he finds out, chapter 1 of verse 15, but after a while, in the time of the wheat harvest, it came about that Samson visited his wife with a young goat and said, I will go into my wife in her room, but her father did not let him enter, and her father said, I really thought that you hated her intensely, so I gave her to your friend. Is not her younger sister more beautiful than she? Please, let her be yours instead. And Samson becomes angry, and it says in verse 4, Samson went out and caught 300 foxes. That's amazing, right there. And took torches. My dad, in his best season of trapping, driving around with a little truck, setting traps and catching foxes. His best year, he made it into the 90s, but he never broke 100 catching foxes in one season. This guy, in the harvest season, catches 300 foxes. Clearly, something supernatural is going on. Ties took torches, turned the foxes loose tail to tail, and put one torch in the middle between two tails. And when he had set fire to the torches, he released the foxes into the standing grain of the Philistines, and thus burning up both the shocks and the standing grain as well as the vineyards and the groves. So God brings judgment on the Philistines then through Samson's anger at the wife being given away to a friend, so that he burns up all of their crops. Another one of the things that happens. Another time down in the context, they actually tie him up with some flax and they lead him off. These are some of his own countrymen, his own men of Judah, come and take him in verses 10 and 11. They take him down and deliver him. But it says in verse 14, when he came to Lehi, the Philistines shouted as they met him, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, so that the ropes that were on his arms were as flax that is burned with fire, and his bonds dropped from his hands. He found a fresh jawbone of a donkey. Again, that would be something that would make him unclean, right? But he grabs it, and so he reached out and took it and killed 1,000 men with it. So we have that he's killed 30 men. We have another situation here where he's killed 1,000. So we've got 1,030 men, which maybe seems like a lot, but it's still not particularly a whole lot. We're going to find out at the end that he's going to kill more in the end of all of this. And then, of course, then we have the problem with Samson getting with Delilah. As a result, Delilah then tricks him into chapter 16, tricks him into finally telling him, because he never, it's this. That didn't work. So, it's this. He keeps lying to her. And finally, she breaks him down, and he tells her exactly how his strength is going to go up. In other words, when his head is shaved, then the vow is gone. That's why the strength leaves. And in that context, it says in verse 19, chapter 16, verse 19, "And she made him sleep on her knees and called for a man and had him shave off the 7 locks of his hair. And then she began to afflict him, and his strength left him." And literally the expression "left him" is his strength went from upon him. Again, reminding us, Samson's not Mr. Atlas. He's being supernaturally made strong. Verse 20, "And she said, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. And he woke from his sleep and said, I will go out as at the other times and shake myself free. But he did not know that Jehovah had departed from upon him." Same expression that's used of his strength departing from upon him in verse 19. So the Holy Spirit here that had been upon him, had been coming upon him, is now departed. And when the Spirit leaves, he loses his strength. Then they make jest with him, poke out his eyes, put him in a prison, running a grinding mill. I've always wondered, this is just Mr. Comic Book Guy, I've always wondered if this was the basis of the stories of Conan the Barbarian, because that's how Conan supposedly got strength, that he was captured as a slave and made to push a grinding wheel around for 15 years until he turns into this warrior. And I always kind of wonder if these stories don't derive from real events that happened. I don't know that. That has nothing majorly to do with this. That has nothing majorly to do with the story or its interpretation. But at the end of all of this, that's right. No. At the end of all of this, after he spent some time in prison in the Philistine prison, his hair, of course, then grows long as a result. They're having a party, verse 27, "Now the house where they're having this party was full of men and women of the lords of the Philistines." So this isn't just average Joe Philistines. This is, remember, the Philistines were predominantly farmers. So we're not talking about just the farmers. We're talking about the people that owned. Remember what the difference between what a lord was? He was a master that had slaves that farmed for him, people that farmed his land, tenant farmers and things like that. So we're talking about these type of people. We're talking about the haves, not the have-nots. "About 3,000 men and women were on the roof looking while Samson was amusing them." So we've got all these people at the party. About 3,000 on the roof. That's not telling you how many are down in the party itself. So there's more in the party. And about 3,000 look on the roof. Verse 28, "And Samson called to the Lord and said, O Lord God, please remember me and please strengthen me just this time, O God, that I may at once be avenged of the Philistines for my two eyes. Samson grasped the two middle pillars on which the house rested and braced himself against them, the one with his right hand and the other with his left. And Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. And he bent with all his might so that the house fell on the lords and all the people who were in it, so that the dead whom he killed at his death were more than whom he killed in his life." We were able to tally up about 1,030. There were probably some others at different times with events that happened. But remember, there's 3,000 on the roof, not to mention the people that are inside, but he kills more at that last vent at his death. His brothers, because apparently his parents didn't have other children, his brothers and all his father's household came down and took and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtol in the tomb of Manoah, his father. And thus he had judged Israel 20 years. So 20 years this had been going on. Keep in mind, some of that time he's locked up in a Philistine prison. In there. But it gives you a perspective. But again now, like Jephthah with his vow being moved, Samson here on one occasion fulfilling a gambling debt, that God, the Spirit when the Spirit came on these people, it was to lead Jephthah in battle. It was to give him, shall we say, cunning and military acumen, you know, trying to, what's the best way? Military strategy. Samson, it's strength to overthrow these people. The Spirit did not come on these people and alter their character. No, it's just the opposite with us. The Spirit's on us, but he doesn't necessarily make a Christian leader a better military leader than an unsaved man. Neither does he make a Christian bodybuilder stronger in any exceptional way than an unchristian bodybuilder, non-Christian. What he does for us is he provides us the ability to have different character, to have the fruit from the Spirit. That's what the Spirit does with us. Christians want the other today. There's a lot of Christians that read these stories, and they read the events in the Gospels, and they are in reality less concerned about having a real substantial change of character than they are of having the ability to do mighty works of power. They so want to be able to do a miracle. They so want to be able to heal. Now, sometimes they may want to heal legitimately because they've got somebody they really care about that they want better. But perhaps they want to heal because they think it would be really cool to do something like that. They're perhaps like one of the early believers that I think was really a believer, Simon Magus, who watched Peter lay his hands on and wanted that, and everybody thinks, oh, he went to hell. He was an unsaved. He was an apostate, an unbeliever. I think he was a believer. But he was a believer who didn't understand the situation in his day. But that's what they want. Okay. But that's the contrast.
On the Nazareth, to learn more about that, you have to go in Leviticus, what?
The book of Leviticus.
Just the whole book?
No. There are specific sections of the book of Leviticus that tell you what a Nazarite is, and I'll have to look that up here in a little bit.
Okay.
Let me just check where we're at here. Put this away so I can see this. Yeah, that's 52 minutes. We're not going to tackle anymore. We're not going to get to the icky story that my wife didn't want to go through tonight. So I guess you guys can read it all this week and find out if you want to come back for that. But there's another rather icky story that goes on here. But again, one of the keys, and we're going to be told that during that story and at the end of that story, is we're reminded in these times there was no king in the land and everybody was doing what was right in his own eyes. And that was exactly what God told them not to do. You are not to do whatever is right in your own eyes. You're to do what's right according to law. And they were not doing that. And that's one of the reasons that they kept turning to these other gods, being sold into slavery by God to these other peoples, and then God happened to raise up a judge to judge them and deliver them. The judges, remember, did the two things. They both provided judgment. We saw that with Deborah last week, as well as delivering them. And that's one of the reasons I believe that they... It's one of the reasons I believe that they actually would have, with some of these, that they would have an extended period of peace. It says here that Samson judged them, but it doesn't say they extended peace. Some of the early ones, they had peace because those judges actually acted like judge, which meant they gave judgment from the law on how these people were to conduct themselves. And then when they would die, then the people would go back because they didn't have somebody saying, hey, quit doing that. You're supposed to be doing this. This is what the law said. When they didn't have that anymore, then those people would go back to those other gods. I think that's important to keep in mind because there's a lot.
How did Samson judge the people and he says, okay, don't marry outside the Israelites, and then he's doing all these, I mean, you know, he's like the worst example.
Precisely. Yeah, I know.
Evidently, in other areas, he was a good judge. I mean, that's all I can think of.
Yes.
But his weakness was women.
Yeah, he had a weakness for women, and apparently on a couple of occasions there, apparently also a weakness for gambling.
And revenge, acting out of anger, tried to use that to his glory.
Yeah, and God actually, and what Josh just referred to, under the law, God allowed that. God allowed vengeance. David avenged things, and David's the one, do not I hate those who hate you? Now, if you and I went around and said that, that wouldn't be a great noble thing. But for David, that was just fine under the law. Because remember, David did not have the Spirit upon him in the way that the Spirit is in us to provide a real change of character. there were some things that the Spirit affected in David, but not in the same way. And that's the same thing with these guys.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay. All of you say hi to Peggy, because you probably won't say hi to her next week. She probably won't come now that she knows me. No. Now, when we get there, some of you probably know what the story is in here, but when we get there, you'll go, yeah.
In Deuteronomy, it says if your wife tries to get you to chase after other gods, you should put her to death.
Yeah.
So, kind of, you didn't do that, even though the Spirit came upon them.
Yeah, but they weren't, God did warn them about, you know, taking their daughters as wives for your sons and giving your daughters as wives to their sons. Okay, let's have a word of prayer. Father, we're thankful. You have, your Spirit is powerful, and He's been active through history, and He was active in the lives of these individuals to deliver your people Israel. But He's active in us today also, but His activity is different, and we're thankful that He's not here just to make us powerful, strong, or particularly sharp in accomplishing great tasks. He's here to provide us the ability to have a distinct kind of character, a character that reflects who your Son Jesus Christ is. And we're thankful for that reality. And help with that not then just to be something that we will say, but something that we actually live out and experience. And we thank you for it. Amen.
I'm not going to get it and do it, but a strength, I might as well give that.